You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today we have the first of two very special shows with Kenward Elmslie, a poet who performs his work, sets music to it, makes the most incredible verbal confections ever to be imagined. It took hearing Kenward to make me know that what poetry was capable of was far more than anything I'd dreamed of. He's supersonic. We're going to go from small works with Kenward Elmslie up to some of his labyrinthine constructions in the course of these two shows, but I thought that we would begin with a lot of breathing space with some of the haiku-like poems that occur in his newest book, Sung Sex. What's the first poem?
Well, I'll start with No and No. Two strangers came by, bow and arrow huntsmen, no. Axer of pine, no. Leave them be as is, I said, the deer and the trees. These haikus were written in Vermont, where I live most of the year. The next one I'd like to read is TV Lunch VT. Steam onion harvest. Fry garlic in olive oil. Add smoked ham, small chunks. Mince coriander. Combine. Top off with young and restless. Upscale. TV fun couple. Home entertainment, cocoon. They want out, crave, risk. Reality inducement, fire engine, ladder cropped. Media Madeline. VCR pulsates. 12, 12, 12, nonstop, nonstop. P Trek, 4 a.m. Flick, flashback, Fleabag hotel, blind, drawn, neon, off, on, off. Stroke, war, NYC, stuck. Boyfriend here and boyfriend there. Romantic adieu. Rest of USA at peace. Dawns on me. Just sneak away.
Some of the pieces have incredible brevity. It's as if any excess word has been sliced out. In fact, I think Kenward Elmslie poems have to be read by a mind equipped to place articles back in the lines, ands and thes, and any bit of latent static that's just there for syntax sake. Is a Kenward Elmslie poem designed to be understood on a first hearing?
Well, that's hard for me to answer because I don't think of audiences when writing. I really write selfishly for myself, and sometimes, like the haikus, I think are a simpler language, which I was happy to see was there, but I didn't aim at it. And some of my work is extremely dense, and I don't really like all of its density, but there's just nothing I can do. That's the way it comes out. Sometimes I've sort of woken up in the morning and seen a couple of lines from a poem on a typewriter page, you know, on my desk, and they seem to have been written by someone else. And then I sort of like them. So it's an interesting challenge. I don't really know who writes them sometimes.
I wanted to hear Air, which was a poem that eventually got set to music. It seems to belong in this set with the haikus because it's made out of sort of abstract planes that meet.
Air, sight impinges on air, divvying it up, night sky, into a cup. Black earth, good omen, full of mica, suspended overhead. It's July, I'm full of joy. No steam heat, no cream teat, no dream meat. Just walking around, watching the cup dump its load right on my head. Cool black jelly, full of glints, hints to remind me of air.
When was that poem written?
Well, it's in a book called Tropicalism, which must have come out in the early 70s. So it goes back a long ways. I began to set my own words to music, and this was one of the poems that just seemed to lend itself to music of my own invention. Even though I'd written it as a honest-to-God poem, I hadn't thought of it as a song, but I just sort of fell into this sort of nervous habit because I have collaborated with with composers and adore these collaborations, and I began to miss collaborating on musicals and operas, and I think this helped take up the slack.
In fact, the first time I heard you read, I had come up to you. There had been in a poem for Anne Waldman a line remembering the pesky Eskimos who don't play lows, and I thought so clearly of the lyricist John Latouche, who had lyrics like these hula dancing mamas are really yama yamas, and I thought, have you heard of him? And you said, he was my beloved. You began really as a kind of fabricator of ingenious musical comedy poems, Girl Machine, for instance, and poems that might be really ensemble pieces. These easy pieces are, you know, almost toss-offs in a way compared to the complexity of some of those later poems. Did they come about in terms of composition simultaneously? Did you start simple and get complicated?
I don't think so. I think I started off writing lyrics for shows and words for operas. And then at a certain point, I think the American Musical Theater began to collapse. And so I got bored trying to write lyrics for shows, and I discovered poetry.
Now, you were called the baby poet. Didn't you once say that in the group that included Ashbery and O'Hara, mm-hmm. that you started writing poetry last? Am I imagining
this? Last. No, that's true, though there were some... I mean, the New York School is now... would form endless, you know, football teams by now. There's so many. But back then, there really were, Barbara Guest, too. And then I sort of, signed on, after the founding brethren, and then after me came the whole Tulsa School of Ron Padgett and Ted Berrigan, and then my collaborator, Joe Brainard.
My first exposure to your work was in an anthology that John Ashbery did, I think, for Penguin, now out of print.
It was an English Penguin, yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. It was Kenneth Koch, James Schuyler, right. and Kenward Elmsley.
Mm-hmm.
And those poems have a kind of funny Midwest in them. Mm-hmm. The Harvey girls are there, and mm-hmm. a lot of Dust Bowl stuff. Where were you born? Were you part of that Americana?
No, and I think that's why I tried to fool people by writing these Midwest poems. We were brought up my father was English, and we were really taught to have an English accent, broad A and everything, but we would always get laughed at school in Colorado Springs, Colorado. So that was my first venture into really playing a part. I developed a kind of natural, what I thought was a natural American voice to just sort of pass, as it were. And so I used, I think, this childhood Midwest identity, which I never felt was that real. But I kept tapping into it, this wanting, you know, to be 100% American for some reason. And so I would write it out in poems.
There's a funny kind of Americana that includes the Ballad of Baby Doe, mm-hmm. perhaps, that Latouche wrote the libretto for, and Rodeo, the Agnes DeMille ballet. Faux Americana, but in your work, intentionally faux, seems to be part of an...
I think of necessity faux because of my odd upbringing. And that, I think, you know, gave it a tension, which I was lucky to have. But I did choose, or subject matters were chosen for me, like the first opera with Jack Beeson doing the music was about Amy Semple McPherson. And that was just a godsend as an idea. In fact, Douglas Moore gave us the idea.
Oh, that is interesting, because thinking of it, that famous evangelist and her money-hustling spiels provide a prototype for a certain kind of Elmsley narrator who, frantically verbal, is trying to pack as much into every square inch of language as can be packed. The interesting then, too, because it seems like... as close to a Noel Coward lyric as imaginable, but before there was Noel Coward, was Ronald Fairbank. And he writes, in a crazy way, faux, what would you call it, ultra-mundane Britannia pieces that, in their crazy curlicues...
Yeah, just fragments of this sort of high life that one can't quite piece together ever.
Right, and that probably didn't exist outside of this
totally
incredible
invented
prose.
Yeah.
And so it seemed to me that your work had taken a crazy American slant on Ronald Fairbank, on that decorated sensibility, and the invention out of the blue of incredible worlds, which leads me to the question of the alphabet. We're going to hear from a section from a work called The Alphabet Work. In fact, the letter M. But I wanted to ask you about the alphabet. You were the founder of a press called Z Press. And frequently there's a funny sense of a kind of parthenogenesis occurring. The alphabet gives birth to incredible numbers of characters, skeezixes, and God knows what else to come crawling from nowhere. The alphabet works. What are they? Where do they come from?
Well, this was for a book called Moving Right Along. That was sort of the first attempt to write an alphabet work, and I found it just so congenial to use this odd 26-letter thing that dominates us all, and from A to Z, just to get from A to Z. And so it worked for that, and then so I used it once again in a sort of big, you know, big book called 26 Bars about drinking establishments, and that was harder. That took years to write, but it finally worked.
We're going to hear the letter M just about midway through the alphabet from the alphabet work, included in the Kenward Elmsley book, Moving Right Along.
Mrs. LaSalle opens the stone door, Mylar Cowtown version. Amphitheater dotted with bony loners. Growing sameness to the summers. Few and far between occasion for eye contact of a promissory nature. Act One. Mrs. Packard coerces her senile mother, Mrs. LaSalle, to simulate an attack of vertigo to throw Clootie, the beggar, off the track. Mrs. LaSalle topples against a cabinet of curios. A jade statuette of the golem shatters. The lights go out, and golems walk into the room through the walls. Act Two. Clootie snoops in Lord Wilson's underground lab. Timelessness soliloquy. A piece of cheesecloth in a sandstorm. Desert air. Savages. Even the most minuscule orifice. Act 3. Princess Lou asks Mrs. Packard and Mrs. LaSalle to spend the night. Mrs. LaSalle tells tall tales of her past. Madame Banco's house, the theft of the Tsarina's life machine. Clootie reminisces about Baron Rapp, the keeper of the wolf head. Act 4. A search party digs away at the entrance to Lord Wilson's underground lab. Mrs. LaSalle hits a rock with her parasol, and a stone door opens. Golem robots emerge into the sunlight, carrying Mrs. Packard on a bier. Clootie enters on a floating throne, holding on his lap the skeleton of Baron Rapp, a wolf head covering his skull. Escort Mosquito back to our side of the island. Gratifying to inch back to the safety of Heartland Innocence.
That was Section M from Kenward Elmsley's The Alphabet Work, included in his book Moving Right Along. Now, it's things like that, things that seem preposterously funny, even when you don't know what they mean, like the theft of the Tsarina's life machine. It's gravity and its simultaneous absurdity. What are some of the contexts that flood into these pieces? Can you define the places from which Kenward Elmsley language is filched and tucked into new places?
Oh, gosh, I just steal wherever I can. It's like a, you know, like this terrible bird darting out and bringing things back to the nest. Like this, of course, is Emma was like inspired by all those dreadful ballet synopses and opera synopses that one encounters in theater programs, which make them all sound just totally absurd, so I tapped into that.
Now, a lot of people think that poetry has to be high-toned, but your sense of the high tone is sort of like W.C. Fields pricking the bubbles of the opera going. He's on the side of the men who fall asleep in a certain sense. You're not quite.
I've fallen asleep quite often myself, so, you know, at high-toned events.
And so recently, though, there have been many incursions into your poetry of really demonic stuff, schlocky and sleazy bits from here and there, mm-hmm. Giving rise to the murmur of very scandalous doings at night in the Palais Bimbo Lounge. What happens there?
Well, I was working with a wonderful composer and collaborator, Stephen Taylor, and we put together an evening of my stuff, poems and poem songs, and theater songs, and it was like a cabaret review. So we needed a scene to flesh out this Palais Bimbo story in which a terrible man called Dr. Moon kills his inamorata, who is a transsexual called Lavinia Sanchez. And so in this song, a hapless tourist is doped to the gills by this horrible Dr. Moon after he's murdered Lavinia Sanchez, and he seeks to find a replacement for this dead inamorata, using this hapless tourist as this enticing image, and she, of course, doesn't want to be Lavinia. So that was the dramatic setup. The character who played it in this off Broadway production was a rhythm and blues singer of great majesty. So I tapped into, for the first time, rhythm and blues to so that she could have something she'd feel comfortable singing.
listeners who so far have been hearing the dulcet tones of Kenward Elmslie can't imagine what they're about to hear, which is Kenward Elmslie singing his schlocken sleaze from, what was it, the Palais Bimbo Lounge Review?
No, this was just called Palais Bimbo, though it's confusing. It started off as an album called Palais Bimbo Lounge Show, and then it led to this cabaret entertainment just called Palais Bimbo. And the song is really sung by both Dr. Moon. So first one hears The Hapless Tourist, then a sort of seduction by Dr. Moon, and then back to The Hapless Tourist resisting this seduction.
We're hearing now Schlock and Sleaze.
Your eyes are the eyes of a terrifying bug. Invented by Hieronymus Bosch, a tarantula part of me wants to hug, and the rest of me wants to squash. If only I knew some magic hocus pocus to tenderize the focus of your eyes. How mucho do I owe you, doctor?
You're Lavinia Bay, the original mold. You're no Xerox. You're Lavinia babe, wanna smother you with rubies and rare rocks. Licking your fangs with your Lavinia tongue, caught in a squeeze between schlock and sleaze. Oh, wow, Lavinia, babe, gotta come hither, look like a cobra. How, Lavinia, babe, love your black leather scanties and no bra. Nuxo Blake, a poco poco to the young, caught in a squeeze between schlock and sleaze. Hang your scuzzy thumb from your wound of a mouth, flirty, flirty. Whisper X-rated come-ons, then get down to it dirty. I want out, doc, spelled O-U-T, out, pretty please. Not my route, doc, sure do miss the birdies and bees. Pull the lever, press the button, catch you later, thanks for nothing. Stuck in a crock between a rock and a hard place, caught in a squeeze between schlock and sleaze. Let me go, doc, back home so I can grab some Z's. Yo-po-po, doc, I'm having an identity crease. I don't need your heebie-jeebies. Stuff your psychedelic freebies. Stuck in a crock between a rock and a hard place, caught in a squeeze between
lock and sleep. Keep climbing up slimy walls. Sounds worse than fingernails scratching a blackboard. Deep in my brain, phony phone-in voices. Yakety-yak, yakety-yak. Board! Terminal on UE is closing in on me. I want out, Doc. Spelled O-U-T out, pretty please. Not my route, Doc. Hallucinating zombies in trees. Next you'll cram me in a body bag with seamless seams. Then gag me so the screams I scream are screamless screams. Stuck in a crock between a rock and a hard place. Caught in a squeeze between schlock and sleeve. I want out, Doc, not my route, Doc. Let me go, Doc, yo-ho-ho, Doc. S-O-S, Doc, whisper yes, Doc. Don't say no, Doc, let me go, Doc. Pure Lavinia, babe, pure Lavinia, babe. Ooh, Lavinia, babe, do Lavinia, babe. Stuck in a crock between a rock and a hard place. Caught in a squeeze.
That was Schlock and Sleaze by my guest Kenward Elmsley, performed by Kenward Elmsley right here in the studio, an amazing thing to happen during an episode of The Bookworm. Would this kind of song be the end of a long composition process? In other words, a book, Bimbo Dirt, became an album, the Palais Bimbo Lounge, which in turn became Palais Bimbo, an off Broadway review, and finally a song.
And finally a song written with music by Steven Taylor. Yes, it is the last round, and hopefully I hope to expand this section of the cabaret into a full length musical for four people.
Those who are interested in the works of Kenward Elmsley, and I hope that's everyone, can contact him care of Z Press, Poets Corner, Calais, Vermont, that's C-A-L-A-I-S, Vermont, 05648. That's Kenward Elmsley, Z Press, Poets Corner, Calais, Vermont, 05648. Kenward, thank you for being with us this week.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The very patient engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, books, books. Too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.